Lisa Ann Gershwin grew up in California, and one day, while visiting a local aquarium, Lisa became fixated on one particular tank where she saw dozens of glowing white moon jellyfish that were just hanging there like clouds in the sky. These alien-looking creatures with a translucent circular bell. But instead of long tentacles, they have this beautiful, delicate little fringe underneath. While most of us are inclined to see jellyfish as gelatinous blobs of menace, to Lisa Ann Gershwin, these were the most uncommonly beautiful and mesmerizing things she'd ever seen. And that day at the aquarium set her life's work in motion. Lisa Ann Gershwin is now one of the world's foremost jellyfish biologists, and she's discovered more than 200 species, including a jellyfish that she named Bazinga. Hi, Lisa.
Aw, Bazinga. What Bazinga. A great way to open.
I know. Let's talk about that. Paint a picture of me, what it looks like.
So it's this little tiny blob. Not little tiny, but it's about the size of a marble. And it's kind of golden colored. And it's got this speckly sort of top, fringy little bottom.
It's like a petticoat? And, like kind of a thing.
Yeah, kind of. Like a petticoat. And it just goes boop, 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 boop. Sound effects mine, of course, but you know, it just does these tiny little pulsations through the water. And it was first brought to me by a photographer, Dennis Reek from Byron Bay. And he sent me this picture of this jellyfish and he said, "What is this? You know, what species? I want to put it up on my website." And I looked at it and I went, "Oh, that's interesting. What size was it?" And he said, "Oh, it was a couple of centimeters." And I went, "Oh, I think it's a baby blubber."
So it just looked like a your bog standard jellyfish, in other words.
Yeah, just like a little brown blubber, right, with, yeah, you know, it did have some different things, but you would expect a baby to look different, yeah, you know, like baby chickens look different than big chickens. Their feathers are different. You know, they have different things. So I thought, oh, okay, it's a baby blubber. So that was that. And, you know, I didn't think much of it. But he lodged the specimens in the Brisbane Museum, the Queen's Museum in Brisbane. So the next time I was at the museum, I stopped in and I thought, oh, I kind of want to see what the baby blubber looks like, you know. So I opened up the jar and there were several specimens in there, I think about five or six specimens. And I poured them out into a petri dish and I looked at them and I went, oh, oh my God, there were actually baby blubbers and there was this other one and they were the same size and I could compare them side by side and it was immediately clear that it was something incredibly different. And I don't mean a little bit different, I mean really different. So, you know, there's like species and then species are clustered into a genus and then genera, you know, plural genus, mm-hmm, genera are clustered into a family, families are clustered into orders, order, and so on, right?
Phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. It's one of the few things I remember from my biology in high school.
See, that's really impressive because I always had to remember it as kinky people come over for group sex.
How is that an accurate, how does that work as an acrostic?
I don't know, but I never forgot it. So sorry, Richard.
That's how the scientific family works. That's a whole other conversation, I think, probably.
I think that's how most scientists remember.
Really? Seriously? So this thing wasn't a baby blubber. It was something else altogether.
It was actually a different species, different genus, different family, different suborder. And the thing that was so amazing was it's really, really, really common in New South Wales and southern Queensland waters. Go figure. Hence the name Bazinga, because, you know, I've got Asperger's. And so, of course, I love the Big Bang Theory. I love Sheldon Cooper, right? And, you know, Sheldon's tagline is Bazinga, meaning, haha, gotcha, fooled you. And so here was this jellyfish hiding in plain sight in a populated area where lots of people are using the water, and nobody noticed it. It even fooled me. I looked at it originally and thought, that's just a baby blubber. So I looked up the word Bazinga to see if it meant anything, and it turns out that the seven-string harp is called a Bazinga, and I couldn't believe my luck, because one of the diagnostic features of this jellyfish is that its internal canals are all parallel, all of the other blubbers have a meshwork, a network of canals. And this one, it's not a meshwork. They're all parallel. And it's a really defining character, and it looks like a harp. And I already had in my mind, I had already put it on the page in the description, that they're straight like a harp or a comb. And then I saw that it was a seven-string harp, and I went, oh my God.
It was meant to be, and you were meant to find that thing.
Absolutely. So this is the bazinga. There you go.
So this is a really kind of kid sort of question. Do they have brains, jellyfish?
No, but it's amazing. So most jellyfish have no brain, no bones, no, you know, anything, right?
No eyes?
No eyes. No. Some of them can, you know, see kind of
photosensors, right, yeah.
I like to tease, you know, that they have, that they're spineless and brainless with no visible means of support. I've dated men like that, but... But the box jellies and irukandjis are so much cooler than that. They're in the class Cubozoa, and they're defined in part by having these really amazing sensory structures. They're called ropalia, and each ropalium, they have four, and each ropalium has two eyes with lenses and retinas and corneas, like our eyes, and they can see pictures, they can see objects, and they have incredibly sophisticated behaviors. They can hunt, they have courtship, they can navigate. These things can see, and they react predictably to, you know, like if you have horizontal bands versus vertical versus oblique, they react predictably. So we know that they see, but they don't have a brain. So a brain develops from what's called mesoderm. It's a type of embryonic tissue. And jellyfish are pre-mesoderm. They evolved before mesoderm evolved. So they don't even have a mesoderm to develop a brain. And yet the cubozoans, which do not have mesoderm, and so they don't have a brain, they've developed a way to see and think and react and process information that we just don't understand.
Wow. Brainless jellyfish that think nonetheless.
They're amazing, right? And deadly at the same time. How cool is that?
All at the same time. Do you ever feel that other people don't see the beauty of jellyfish like you? I mean, I have been mesmerized by jellyfish. You know, I was actually, for my sins, was on a cruise recently for a friend and just saw this kind of, you know, massive jellyfish in the water. And they do make you sort of go momentarily, ooh, they are beautiful. But is it frustrating to you sometimes people just don't see that kind of moon-like luminous beauty of jellyfish?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. So jellyfish are definitely having their day at the moment. You know, they're all over Pinterest and, you know, all over Facebook, and people are packing into public aquariums to see them, and people have jellyfish tattoos, and I love it because I think it's great that people are seeing them as beautiful and amazing, because they are. But, you know, there also is another side to them. Some of them are deadly to humans. And they're also a visible indicator and a driver of changes in the ecosystem. But my hope is that by people seeing them as beautiful creatures, that it's sort of almost an artistic way of getting into people's minds and souls about this other role that they play.
Now, Lisa, you grew up in a place in California called the Valley of Enchantment. You see, that's the difference between the United States and Australia right there. Like, we name places like Lake Disappointment, but you grew up in the Valley of Enchantment.
Misery Swamp.
Misery Swamp, yeah. That's right, yes. You had a menagerie in your bedroom. What kind of stuff did you have in your bedroom?
I had a desk, and on this desk was a big round glass globe with a sidewinder that lived inside there.
What's a sidewinder?
Sidewinders are these weird rattlesnakes that move sideways. Instead of, you know, like snakes are supposed to move, they go forward, right? These don't go forward, these go sideways.
Oh, right, I've seen those. And like across, they move across sand like
that,
don't
they? Yeah, they're really freaky. So I had a pet sidewinder in this tank. Also on the desk, I had a 10-gallon aquarium, you know, normal, everyday, you know, 40-liter tank. And I had a gopher that lived in there. So the tank was filled with dirt. And every night, the gopher would spend all night making these tunnels and places to sleep and little nooks and crannies. And then it would sleep all day. And then at the evening, it would wake up and it would tear down everything. And it would spend all night rebuilding them again. And then it would sleep. And so it went every day. And under the desk, I had a bat that lived under the desk. And it would come out and it would fly around and eat bugs and whatever.
What? Really? A living bat?
A living bat. It was cool. Yeah. It was amazing. And so those were the more interesting creatures. But I had two entire walls of my room. One wall was almost floor-to-ceiling shelves with dry things like snakes and lizards and things like that, mice to feed them and, you know, whatever. And then the other wall was all wet stuff. So it was like salamanders and fish and...
How are your parents? Like, if I'm your dad, Lisa, I'm thinking to myself, it's so cool my daughter's into this stuff and she's got this fierce curiosity, but she's got a goddamn bat in her room. How are your mum and dad with all that, Lisa?
They kind of didn't like some of the things I had. You know, I think most of the time they just kind of didn't come into my room, you know.
So now tell me, Lisa, about the small business you had going.
Oh, yeah, this was crazy. Age of 10. Because I was so into lizards and snakes and, you know, all these things. And people would come to my parents and you know, like I didn't advertise or anything, but word kind of got around, as you might imagine. And so people would come to my parents and they'd say, oh, you know, could we get Lisa to come check out our pest problem? You know, maybe they had spiders or, you know, mice or whatever. And so I'd go over there and I'd kind of check it out and I'd look in their closets and under the counters and nooks and crannies, whatever, and talk to them and, you know, how many mice have you seen where, you know, this kind of thing. And I'd get a feel for it. And I'd say, all right, well, I think you need, you know, this many of this type of snake and this many of this type of lizard. And we'll put, you know, these here and those there. And so I'd go and I'd catch the animals and I'd bring them back, let them go in their house. And then I'd come back after like a week or 2 weeks or whatever and retrieve the animals that I could find. Cause I mean, inevitably there was some attrition, you know, and if they needed more to kind of top it off because maybe, you know, they'd left too early and, you know, needed to still do some more work or whatever. And so I had this crazy pest control business.
And it worked?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. And obviously, I mean, they had to be people who didn't mind a snake in the bedroom, you know, or whatever.
But, you know, completely non-toxic, that's the lovely thing about it, as a form of pest control. And you were how old when you were doing this?
Yeah, I was like 10, 11, 12. 10?
You know, and you were making good money from this?
Yeah.
Wow. That's fantastic. We haven't even got to how you got into jellyfish, but this is the start of it. So you go on this field trip, and this is what takes you to an aquarium for the first time. Tell me what happened that day, please.
Oh, this was extraordinary. So I was, you know, like right into lizards and snakes and stuff like that. I was in third grade, and my teacher, Mrs. Downs, I think she maybe saw something in me that she wanted to cultivate, you know. And so, like, there would be a roadkill somewhere in town, and she would get a hold of it, and I'd go over to her house, and she would walk me through the dissection, and she indulged my fascinations in science. You know, this was just a thing that she really helped me, I guess, have an outlet, and not just an outlet, but a source of amazement
rather than embarrassment, which is great.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank God you found her, or she found you.
Yeah. Yeah, she was fantastic. So in her third grade class, every year she took her third grade class on this field trip to the Cabrillo Marine Museum, it was called at the time. Now it's actually switched to being the Cabrillo Marine Aquarium, but never mind. And in my class, when I was in third grade, we went there as normal. And, you know, we went out whale watching, and all the other kids are like, oh, wow, the whales, the dolphins, wow. And I was over there just puking, you know, I was so seasick. I was pathetic. But after the trip, we went back to the museum and I started looking at all of these interesting things they had there. And I was absolutely rapt with the hermit crabs and the octopus. Absolutely rapt.
Why?
I've never seen anything so fantastically strange. And okay, I can't help myself. I'm drawn like a moth to a light to anything fantastically strange. And these were, I mean, come on, octopus, come on.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And hermit crabs, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I could look at octopus footage all day. So you're looking at that and you're looking at hermit crabs as well.
And I was absolutely fascinated. So I came home from that trip knowing I was going to be a marine biologist. There was no question in my mind I was definitely going to become a marine biologist. voraciously reading everything I could get a hold of. My mom would have to go to the library and order new books that they didn't have yet because I was demanding more stuff to read. You know, Jacques Cousteau would come on TV and I didn't care. It could be Christmas Day at the family. I didn't care. Nope, nope, we've got to watch Jacques Cousteau because, okay, I was kind of a demanding child.
What you'd expect to happen next is that you study really hard, you go straight into a course in marine biology at university.
You'd think so.
What happened?
People who loved me, my family, my teachers, you know, people who cared about me, gave me a lot of helpful messages. Well, they thought they were helpful, and I thought they were helpful too, but I didn't realize how harmful they were. They told me things like, there's a lot of school, and you have to be really smart. You know, the classes are really hard. The implication being that I wasn't, and I believed it. And they said that there aren't very many jobs and they don't pay well. And that's true, by the way. But what they didn't tell me, and I wish they had, was that if you love it so much that it's like air or water, like you need it for your mental health, like you need it, that you find a way, and that you don't need a job that pays really well because you only need all that money to buy things to entertain you because you don't like your job. If you like your job, you don't have time for all those other things to entertain you because you're way too interested in what you're doing. So those are the things they didn't tell me. So I veered off.
You were discouraged.
I was discouraged. I went off and I tried things to make money. I became a stockbroker. I became an accountant. I went into business. I worked in retail. I did waitressing. I did so many things, and I didn't love them. They weren't fulfilling. And even like as a stockbroker, I made so much money. I mean, hand over fist, I made tons of money, but I didn't love it.
Now, this is in Los Angeles, California,
LA, yeah.
And this is a complete left turn in your life story.
Yeah.
But for a while, you did work in a really nice cinema in Malibu. Who would come through the door? Who would come through the turnstile at that cinema?
Richard, you wouldn't imagine. So it was the only entertainment in town, and everybody came through that turnstile. And by everybody, I mean everybody.
When you say everybody, you mean like movie stars, proper
movie
stars?
Yeah, movie stars and politicians and everybody.
And what was the policy of this cinema when it came to movie stars wanting to come into the cinema?
You got to understand Dave O'Mara, the owner. He was this crotchety, angry, loved a good fight, would win an argument no matter what. He was a scary guy, right? With a heart like a marshmallow. He was the nicest, most generous man in the world. And I loved him with all my heart. He was my best friend. But most people were really scared of him. And he ran the Malibu Cinema like a dictator might run a country. Dave's rules are the highway. You know, everybody had to pay. Absolutely no freebies. Except if you had won an Academy Award, then you could get in once for the movie that you got the Academy Award for. Not with a whole swag of people, only you, and only once, and only for the movie you got the Academy Award for. And that was the only concession he would make to somebody coming through that turnstile without paying
for it. Right, so if Dustin Hoffman came in to see Kramer versus Kramer, he could get in.
Once.
Only
that's
once.
That's
it, right.
That's
okay.
It. And so Barbara Streisand came in, and I think the movie was Yentl. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure it was Yentl. And she came up and she said, I've got some friends with me, and, you know, I wanted to see if, you know, we could get in. And Dave said, yes, it'll be, you know, X amount, whatever it was, you know, like five times the ticket cost or whatever, right? So her friends are right there with her, right? She says, you know, I know you have a policy about Academy Award winners getting in for free. And he said, no, you already came in for this movie. So here it goes. This epic argument is about to happen. And of course, I'm over there working popcorn and I'm seeing this and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
She still wants to get in free, does she?
Yeah.
Right, even though she's gotten in free once.
Yeah.
She wants to go in to see the second time with friends, but she wants to get in free.
Well, she's a very powerful woman,
of course. Yes, but also a very rich woman as well.
I don't think it was about the money.
Right.
I think it was about winning the fight, you know? Because Dave had such a reputation
right.
that like nobody could win an argument with Dave. All right, so, I think Barbara felt she could.
Right.
So they get into this, you know, yes, no, right? And then he starts to explain. He says, I have to pay for every butt that goes through that turnstile, and I'm not paying for your butt. You know, he says, the only way you're going through that turnstile for free is if you get on your hands and knees and crawl under it. And she went, oh, okay. And Richard, I kid you not, with my hand to my heart, she did. She did.
Barbara Streisand got on her hands and knees to crawl under the turnstile?
She did, in front of her friends and in front of everybody at the Malibu Cinema that night. She did.
See, it's amazing you became a jellyfish scientist, because I think that experience alone would want to keep you in the box office for the rest of your life to see such a thing ever happen again.
Just, yeah, exactly. Just for one more time to have a camera handy.
So what made you decide to go back to school and point yourself towards marine biology?
Well, it was kind of a unconventional thing, I think. So I was great in grade school. Absolutely loved it. Loved the science, loved learning and all that, right? High school was a disaster for me. I was bullied very badly. My family was falling apart. It was just a disaster. So I really fell off the rails in junior high and high. And I hated being smart. So as a child, I was smart and it was good. But when you get to junior high and high, being smart is the worst thing in the world. So I wasn't smart. I didn't ask questions. I didn't engage. So I got to high school and I did very badly. Like, I only took art and fencing. And I guess because I was going through so many problems, they just let me fall off the rails. I think they just kind of went, well, you can't help everybody, you know. So I left school halfway through 10th grade. And by California standards, illiteracy is defined by not having graduated high school. So to this day, I'm still defined, or I'm a statistic for illiterate people in California. And Dave O'Mara from the Malibu Cinema, the owner, was always telling me, you should go back to school, you should go back to school. And he'd always tell me, you're so smart, you could be anything. Anyway, I applied for law school because I thought, well, I love to argue, might as well get paid for it. And bonus, I'd get paid so well that 2 weeks a year on vacation, I'd be able to go to places like Tahiti or the Great Barrier Reef and indulge in marine biology to my heart's content. I'd be able to go scuba diving. I'd be able to see stuff. And I had never lost this passion for marine biology, but I recognized that I wasn't smart enough and just wouldn't be able to do it professionally. But if I had enough money, I could. So I applied to law schools. And while I was waiting for an answer, I decided to take a marine biology class at what's called a community college. It's kind of like TAFE, and it changed my life. There I am in this class, and every single thing the instructor said was every reason I loved marine biology. And I was sitting front and center, and you got to picture this. It was terrible. So I was front and center, and every single thing, my hand shoots up. I've got a question. People behind me are throwing spitballs at my hair, and, you know, they're like, no, shut up, you know, and I didn't care. So the last field trip of the semester, we were supposed to go on a fishing boat. And the weather was so bad, it got canceled. So we're there at the wharf, and the professor says, all right, well, you guys, you got a choice. If you just want to go home and call it a day, that's fine. You know, I won't grade you off for missing it. But if anybody wants to go to the Cabrillo Marine Museum, I'm happy to go, and we can have a little bit of a, you know, kind of continue on and see cool stuff. And I went, oh, Cabrillo Marine Museum. Wow, hadn't been there in almost 20 years, right? When I had originally been there, it was the 21st of January of 1973, and this was the 21st of December of 1992. So it really was, I know, you're looking at me like,
how do you remember that?
But
These are life-changing moments, that's why.
They were. They were like birthdays for me. And maybe the Asperger's has something to do with it. So I was like, Cabrillo Marine Museum, I want to go, you know. So most of the class went, actually. I don't think anybody didn't go. So there we were, and I come around this bend, and there were these jellyfish. And they were amazing. They didn't look alive, but they were. And They were so beautiful and so mesmerizing, and they just captured my heart. And I stood there for the longest time just watching these otherworldly beings, and I was absolutely spellbound. And then I became aware that off to the left, most of my class was piled into this little tiny, tiny, tiny room, and somebody was telling them stuff about the jellyfish. Whoa, okay, hang on. Hello, you know. So I'm over there out of the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so the guy's just finishing up, and he says, does anybody have any questions? Well, my hand shoots up. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, you in the back. And I said, I just came in. Could you start from the beginning? You know, and my class is all like, no. You know, they all go filing past me. So this guy really did, like, he told me all kinds of amazing stuff about their life cycle and about how they were breeding them there and all this. And I was just fascinated. I asked him so many questions, and he was so kind answering all of them. And eons later, you know, he said, do you have any more questions? And I said, yeah, just one. I said, how does somebody volunteer to be a slave around here? And he looked at me and he said, well, if you're serious, I could really use somebody to help with the jellyfish. And I looked at him and I cocked my head and I said, well, if you're serious, I'm serious. And this beautiful direction in my life was born in that moment. It was a love affair that continues to this day with jellyfish. And I stayed for 4.5 years. And the only reason I left was I got a scholarship to do a PhD at Berkeley.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Once you arrived in Australia and you saw what kind of jellyfish we have in Australia, what was the first thing you noticed about our
jellyfish? Yeah, so actually, so I came here, and I think it might have been around day three, I realized that most of the jellyfish that were known from Australia had been wrongly identified. And what this meant was that the research I was going to do, it wasn't going to have any comparability or any credibility to it because the species were wrong.
All right, you couldn't even begin.
Couldn't even begin.
Right.
Yeah.
So then it's a question of taxonomy, the naming of things.
Well,
then.
So this was the thing. So I bought a car and hit the road, and I looped Australia 2.5 times in a year.
You went right around Australia 2.5 times.
Yes, I did. And it was fantastic. Best road trip of my life. And in that year, I discovered 38 new species, and I fell in love with Australia and decided to immigrate. It was an extraordinary year.
In 2002, you classified a deadly new species of Irukandji jellyfish. And before we go further, I should say you've actually brought in an Irukandji jellyfish in a little vial. It's this little thing. And the thing that surprises me most is I don't have this image in my mind that jellyfish are of a certain size. They're something the size of, I don't know, sort of like a tennis ball or something with tendrils off it. This is tiny, this thing. It's like, it's not even as big as a marble. It's so small and yet so toxic.
So toxic.
So tell me about this new species of Irukandji jellyfish that you found.
Oh, well, I found more than one. So there's currently 16 known species of Irukandjis, and I've named and classified 14 of the 16. Most of the stings are from that one.
From this one, right.
Yeah, most people don't get stung, of course. But the other species range in size from about that size all the way up to a body length of 50 centimeters, half a meter long. I mean, they can be huge and still cause Irukandji syndrome. And strangely enough, there's no relationship between the size of the animal and the severity of the syndrome.
There was an American tourist who came to Australia called Robert King who got stung by an Irukandji jellyfish.
Yeah, very tragic.
Tell me about how that unfolded and what that meant for your understanding of Irukandji syndrome.
Yeah, so I was approached by a doctor, Peter Fenner, and he had some specimens of what he thought might be a new species. He was really thrilled that I was here. So he arranged to meet me and give me some specimens of this. And this is how I got into Irukandjis. I was able to figure out that it was indeed new to science. And it had this very strange feature on its tentacles that made me think it could be deadly. typical Irukandji gives you this unbelievably severe lower back pain, like an electric drill drilling into the back,
really
severe, plus relentless nausea and vomiting, difficulty breathing, profuse drenching sweating, full body cramps and spasms, a feeling of impending doom, and that's just normal Irukandji. There are some species that also cause severe hypertension or high blood pressure, and the highest published was 280 over 180, which is enough to actually hemorrhage the brain, you know, heart attacks. I mean, all kinds of severe complications when the blood pressure is that high. And so this idea was forming about the capability to kill and the role that the high blood pressure played in that, and this new species with these stinging cells that were clearly built for killing. They were clearly deadly machines. They had that look to them. And then in 2002, a British tourist, Richard Jordan, died from an Irukandji sting at the Whitsundays. And it didn't raise much of a ruckus because he had a history of some cardiac problems. And people went, all right, well, yeah, I mean, you know, that could happen. 2 months later, late March, Robert King from America was stung off of Port Douglas at Opal Reef. And he was healthy. He was 44 years old. And he had a very, very bad sting. And it hemorrhaged his brain in 5 places. And that changed everything. The tourism industry lost $65 million from cancellations and things like that. And it was absolutely devastating. So I was back in Berkeley by then, working on my PhD there. My Fulbright had already been over, and I had to go back. Didn't want to go back. Wanted to stay, but couldn't, you know, had to go back. I was contacted by a representative of the Queensland government, and they said, we need you to come and do the taxonomy on the Irukandjis. You're the only person that has the knowledge able to identify who killed this tourist. And right away, I knew that it had to have been this new species, which wasn't yet named and classified, but I already suspected it was lethal. So, of course, I said, well, I can't come. You know, I'm in the last year of my thesis. I'm writing up. I can't come. And they said, we'll make it worth your while. And I said, I can't. I'm finishing my thesis. And they said, well, what if we could arrange for you to finish your thesis here? And I said, I'll be on the next plane. So I started a whole new thesis. So I needed to get a specimen where I could get good photographs and I could get the DNA. And so early in my thesis, I was talking to a friend. We're walking along the marina in Port Douglas, and I'm asking him, oh, can you, you know, get me a specimen if you see one? I really need one. You know, keep it alive, blah, blah, blah. We're walking along, and he says, oh, there's one right there. And I look down and was like, oh, my God. God. So I said, go get a bucket. So he runs to get a bucket and he says, keep an eye on it. You know, so I'm watching it. And it starts diving down. Oh my God. No. So I instinctively reached down and I grabbed it. I picked it up in my hand.
You picked up the Irukandji, this lethal Irukandji?
That I was really sure was lethal.
What did you think, or was it just instinct?
No, I wasn't thinking. It was instinct. I wasn't thinking at all. And it stung the hell out of my hand. It stung so bad. And I just, I just dropped it, you know. And then I thought, oh, wait. And I picked it up again. And I was holding it in water in my hand. And it was stinging and stinging and stinging and stinging. And I kept thinking, I'm going to die. My friend comes up and he looked at me. His eyes were this wide. And he goes, what have you done? And I said, put water in a bucket, you know. So he did. And I plunked it in there. And I said, I need vinegar right now, immediately. I need vinegar. So we went and got vinegar. And then he goes, oh, my God, it's my son's birthday. I've got to go. And I'm like, you can't leave me. You cannot leave me, because I'm still thinking I'm going to die, you know. But, I mean, okay, I'd already been stung. If you're going to die, you might as well at least have the specimen for science, if you're going to die, right?
And at this point, are you feeling any of the onrush of symptoms you're talking about?
Nothing.
That sense of doom, the lacerating back pain?
Nothing.
The nausea, all of that?
Nothing.
No.
No. I had a feeling of impending doom, but it wasn't that feeling of impending doom. It was a different feeling.
It's because you were being stung.
It was an
right.
intellectual
right,
feeling
yes.
of impending doom.
And a perfectly rational one. Too.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the normal feeling of impending doom associated with the Irukandji is actually a psychotic effect of the venom. So anyway, we plunged my hands into a bowl of vinegar. So it wasn't just a spray of vinegar or a douse of vinegar. This was immersion in vinegar. And I said, you can't leave me. You got to stay. And so he stayed for about a half hour, and I was fine. I was completely fine. And I...
Why? How?
Yeah,
how
I don't know. I think it might have been having the vinegar so early. I really don't know how it is that I was so lucky in that circumstance to not end up really, really sick.
What do you like emotionally while this is going on? Because you thought you...
Oh, I was wrecked. I was sure I was going to die. I really was.
Yeah, and then when you knew you weren't?
It changed my life immensely in terms of respecting safety. And I became a crazy safety woman. I mean, I was sure I was going to die. And I was even telling him, I'm like, write this down. You know, I was giving him the password to my bank account. I was giving him, you know, my details of my next of kin. I was giving him all these details. I'm like, write this down, you know. Yeah, I'm embarrassed at what I did. I'm ashamed at what I did. It was stupid writ large.
Well, it's just impulsive. I mean, you didn't think to yourself, I'll pick up a jellyfish, I'll be all right. It's
no,
just impulsive.
But when you know that something's so dangerous, you know, like it needs to filter into your brain so you don't do stuff like that. You know, you can't do impulsive things with dangerous things. Herein lies the problem.
Well, maybe this is just the flip side of how much these creatures have beguiled you. They so absorb your mind, they take up the totality of the whole front space of your mind. You went, oh, it's getting away, better pick it up. Oh, that was a bad idea. maybe that's what this is the flip side of the same thing that caught you when you were looking at those moony jellyfish in that aquarium.
They are amazing. They do beguile me, yeah.
You did say you have been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. What was life like before you had that diagnosis and trying to make sense of why you are the way you are?
Yeah, like so many people like me, I had a really bumpy life. My Asperger's was not invisible. Everybody knew there was something going on. The term Asperger's syndrome hadn't been invented yet when I was a kid. Everybody always said things like, there's something wrong with that girl. And that concept of there's something wrong, I find weird.
I do too. Like, it seems to me that sometimes you can pathologize what is just overbounding curiosity and enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
But I mean, like, why is that wrong? It's, you know what wrong, I mean? There's nothing inherently wrong. And I, through most of my life, I genuinely believed that there was something wrong with me, that I was defective or I was broken. I believed this. And so, you know, I've gone through life apologizing for wanting somebody's time, apologizing for wanting to love someone because I felt that I didn't have the right to be loved or to ask somebody for their time.
Well, because you were broken.
I didn't deserve it. I'm broken. You know, I'm defective. So much of my life, I've wanted to find what was wrong with me, because if I could find what it was, maybe I could fix it. Or if I couldn't fix it, maybe I could at least find a pathway that other people with this wrong thing have traveled that might make mine less bumpy. I called this thing ERT.
And where did you get that name from? Where did ERT come from?
Well, there's this inertia that's holding me back from being the me that I want to be and need to be and feel I have the right to be. So the opposite of inertia would be ertia. And so if I could find that ert, that's the opposite of inertia. And so I've had, since I invented this as maybe a young teenager or something. And so my whole life I've been in search of ert. And by the way, I believe I found it. So with all of this going on and this lifetime of searching for ert, my boss comes to me one day, and this was in January of 2010, and I had a really great relationship with my boss. You know, we joked around, and we could talk openly. I mean, he was my boss, like I respected that, but he got me. He got me. And he came to me one day, and he's holding this book, and he said, I'd like you to read this. I think you have this. And I look at the book, and it's The Complete Guide to Asperger's by Tony Atwood.
Oh, right. He's been on the show twice.
Oh, he's magnificent.
Yeah.
I love the man. Yeah. And I looked at this, and I laughed out loud, and I actually used a bad word. So I told him, I said, ha, fuck off. I don't have that. And he said, Lisa, I think you do, and I'd like you to read this. I'm asking you as your friend, and I'm asking you as your boss, I'd like you to read this because I think it'll answer a lot of questions for you. And that really kind of hit me. It was like, wow, he's really serious about this. And I respect him immensely. And so I thought, okay, I'll read it. And Richard, it was the most amazing thing. I couldn't believe. Every page was my biography. I couldn't believe that somebody who had never met me, this is Tony Atwood, somebody who had never met me got me so much. He knew what I thought. He knew what I felt. The stories he told were my stories. The scenarios he gave, I had had those same scenarios. The feelings were mine. It was incredible.
And what were some of the behaviors you recognized?
Oh, it was everything. Like just everything from monologuing to special interest to complete inability to read between the lines of what people mean to being blunt to it goes on and on and on.
So you at the aquarium when everyone's just left the room, you're still asking questions of the jellyfish expert.
That was classic.
Again and again and again and again and again and saying, what do I need to become a slave to become your slave? That, in this case.
Classic Asperger's.
That pursuit of your thing that fascinates you, that's classic.
Oh, yeah. Sense. And just like complete inability to consider what anybody else thinks or feels. It's not because I'm rude or mean. It's because other people just aren't on my radar.
You can't read it, perhaps.
I can't read it. Yeah. And I can't imagine what they think or feel. I just can't. Like, I can look at you, and you can be glancing at your watch every few seconds, thinking to yourself, why isn't she noticing I'm glancing at my watch? And I see that you're glancing at your watch, but I don't know what you mean by it. Now I know. Finally, somebody told me that's people's way of saying, shut up. But I didn't know that. So Tony has this thing that he talks about where people with Asperger's don't learn sandbox rules. And I think that sums up my life. You know, in the sandbox, when other children were learning how to interact with other kids and the right behaviors to respect other people's boundaries and needs, I was off chasing bugs. I'm just different. And I actually think that Asperger's is the very heart of what makes me the scientist that I am. I wouldn't give it up for all the money in the world. The thing about Asperger's is, you know, people say that, oh, you know, people with Asperger's have a problem with people, you know, whatever. No, not really. Oh, well, maybe it is a problem with people. But Tony Atwood has this thing that he does. You know, he opens some of his talks by saying that he's found the cure for Asperger's. And, of course, that really gets people's attention. So he says that the cure for Asperger's is to shut the door. Because when you're alone by yourself in a room, you don't have Asperger's. You have the best life in the world. You only have Asperger's when you have to interact with people who don't.
Jellyfishes, you mentioned before, when there's a bloom of jellyfishes, it's often a sign, you said, that something's out of whack. Why does that happen? What is it about jellyfish that indicates that something's out of whack with the marine environment?
Yeah, so jellyfish have this fantastic ability to be both a visible indicator that something's wrong in the environment, but also to be a driver of whatever's out of balance becoming even more out of balance. And they have this incredibly simple thing that they do that's incredibly devastating to ecosystems. In a healthy ecosystem, jellyfish can't really take control because they're not as good of predators or competitors as fish. But when things kind of wobble a bit and maybe we take too many fish out through fishing or pollution or whatever, or we change the temperature so that the fish have a harder time surviving, but the jellyfish are stimulated to grow more, something happens. The balance changes. And then jellyfish do this thing. They eat fish, eggs, and larvae, and they eat the plankton that the larvae would eat. And this double whammy of predation and competition can absolutely take over an ecosystem really fast. So when they eat the eggs and larvae and the plankton, everything up the food chain collapses. They're doing this many, many places around the world. We've seen many, many places flip to being dominated by jellyfish. And it's very, very hard to get them to flip back once that happens. So,
but if they're chewing the grass right down to the roots, if you like, I mean, that's the kind of marine equivalent of that. Sooner or later, that environment becomes barren. And what happens then? Do they then die off?
Or
they
go elsewhere? No.
No?
So they don't need to eat very much. So, you know, they're these incredibly simplistic creatures. So if there's a shortage of food for a while, they just slowly degrow. They just get smaller and smaller and smaller, but it doesn't hurt them at all. And then when there's food available again, you know, another rush of nutrients, another rush of plankton, whatever, then they start eating again and they're fine. You know, I mean, they're incredible. Like they can clone in 13 different ways, which I just find so mind-blowingly cool. And at least 4 species are truly biologically immortal. I mean, come on, these are cool animals.
You mean the cells don't age, you mean? They don't
experience senescence? No, I mean, so you've got your jellyfish, like, pop, 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 right? You kill it, either through, you know, squishing it or it dies naturally or whatever. And usually when things die, the cells kind of dissociate and it becomes like a little lump of gooey cells, right? You know, things decay.
Uh-huh.
Well, you kill a jellyfish of these immortal types. You kill them, and instead of decaying, the cells reaggregate into another life stage.
A zombie jellyfish?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. How cool is that? So researchers have gotten them to go through many iterations of this, and they just keep living, and they just keep reiterating.
Let me just sum something up here then, please. Lisa, you're talking about phosphorescent creatures that are, in some cases, quite unkillable, that will chew everything right down to the roots, can shrink when they need to and regrow.
And clone in 13 different ways. And live forever. Welcome to my world. Seriously, how cool is that?
And seriously, what's the solution? Is it for us to eat jellyfish?
No, herein lies the problem. So if you fish out the jellyfish, it seems like that would take care of the problem, but it won't. But jellyfish have a secret weapon. So their life cycle is really weird. When jellyfish have babies, they don't grow up to look like jellyfish. They grow up to look like little tiny polyps or like little tiny sea anemones. They stick to rocks and shells and things like that, right?
Oh, man, you'll never get them out.
No, exactly. But it's even worse than that. So that's the clonal part right there, right? I like to think of them like apples and apple trees, right? So you take out a jellyfish, it's like picking an apple off the tree or off the ground. Well, the tree is still there. So with jellyfish, the polyps are still there. But in this case, the apple trees are clonal. So they're making more and more and more apple trees in front of you as you're frantically running around picking apples up off the ground.
Oh, it's
they're
it's
making
pointless.
More and more.
Right.
Yeah.
So fishing them out is just pointless in the end.
Yeah.
So what's to be done then? What's to be done when you have these kind of infestations of jellyfish that are destroying an ecosystem?
Well, so if you can restore a healthy ecosystem before they get out of hand, that's the best. Hands down, definitely, that's the best. And that's just about leaving intact or recreating intact the healthy ecosystem that has the predators and competitors
right.
in place.
So don't overfish it. Leave the fish there so they can eat the jellyfish.
Don't overfish it.
So what would happen in a damaged area if you just stopped fishing? Would the fish population be restored?
If you're still fishing and getting fish, then maybe, yeah. Then it's not so far gone. But many of the really heavily damaged places, it's beyond fishing. There's no fish left. So
what do you do?
It's not an easy one. These ecosystems where jellyfish have taken over are very, very resilient to flipping back. We don't have a way to do it yet. Now, the best example is the Black Sea. It was so devastated by this one species of jellyfish, you can't imagine. It was introduced in ballast water into the Black Sea accidentally in the early 90s. And within just a few years of its introduction, it had exploded in numbers and eaten its way through the food chain to the extent that 95% of the biomass in the Black Sea was this one species of jellyfish. 95%. It had eaten the entire food chain at the larval and plankton level. It was unbelievable. And everything, seabirds, marine mammals, everything above collapsed. It was devastation. And when the Soviet Union broke up, the government stopped the fertilizer subsidies to the farmers. So there was less fertilizer waste running into the Black Sea. Around that same time, the fishing had collapsed so completely that the fishermen went bust. So they couldn't fish anymore. There was nothing to fish. And also right around that same time, a little jellyfish called Baroe was accidentally introduced in ballast water, and it's a native predator in America of Nemeopsis. So you've got this triple whammy all at the same time that whacked the Nemeopsis. But you could never create a situation like that. I mean, you could never, you know, like, say, I don't know, for, you know, the South China Sea, stop the inflow of nutrients, stop all of, you know, everything going on. I mean, you just can't, you know, it's impossible.
So eventually governments will be coming to you, Lisa, I suppose, and saying, what can you tell us?
Yeah, sadly, nobody wants to listen to my solution.
Just don't muck it up in the first place.
Don't muck it up in the first place.
Just finally, Lisa, you mentioned that ERT was the thing you were looking for. That was the thing, the opposite of inertia.
My search for ERT.
And did you find your ERT?
Yeah, I have. So for me, ERT is having a purpose. That's what it is. It's having a purpose. So for me, it's jellyfish. But I don't think it needs to be jellyfish for everybody. But it's having a purpose. It's finding meaningful employment. It's finding a meaningful hobby that absorbs your fascination to a place where depression just can't get in. It just doesn't, it just can't exist when you're in that place. So that's ERT. Find something you love.
Well, I've loved speaking to you, Lisa. That has been great. That's my ERT for today, in any case.
Thank you, Richard. You're fabulous.
It's been such a pleasure.
Broadcast, podcast, on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to jellyfish scientist Lisa Ann Gershwin in 2017. I'm going to be away for the next few weeks. I'm going to be working on a special Conversations project that we're planning for the end of the year, and we're all very excited about. Sarah Konoski will be with you from tomorrow, and I'll be back at the start of May. Don't forget, all our conversations are available as a podcast and on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. See you in May. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.